accession number 19853, reel 1.
Brigadier Firth, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Cambridge.
Which year was this?
In 1919.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Cambridge?
No. I was a family of five of us and we all went away to boarding school.
Whereabouts to?
My school?
Yes.
I went to Christ's Hospital.
How old were you when you left there?
I was 17.
So that must have been in 36?
Yes.
And after that?
After that, I went straight to Sandhurst and straight into the army.
Why did you decide to go in for an army career?
I don't know. I always wanted to follow in my father's footsteps, I suppose, so I followed him into the army and into his regiment.
What did you think of the course that you had at Sandhurst?
Absolutely first class, from my point of view.
And then you got a commission into the Duke of Wellington's?
Correct.
When was that?
In January 1939.
Had you expected, when you decided to go to Sandhurst, that a war was coming?
Oh, yes. We'd already had the Phoney War. My last year at Sandhurst. And digging trenches all over the place, and grounds at Sandhurst.
And
that's as far as anybody at that age ever thought about anything terribly serious.
What happened to you in 1939?
I went to my regiment, the Duke of Wellington's regiment, at Borden Camp between January and that summer, and then all us young ones were sent off to India to make way for people to come back, more experienced people to come back from India and come back and lead the reserve army and generally bolster up the UK army.
When was it that you went to India?
I sailed on the first convoy of the war from Greenock. And before we could sail, us young officers were put over the side and had to paint the ship grey because it was a Cunarder straight off the Atlantic run.
So this was the autumn of 39, wasn't it?
Yep.
Where did you go to once you got to India?
We landed at Bombay and I went straight up to Delhi.
To
join our 2nd Battalion, which was there. There were five of us in the Duke of Wellington's regiment, and we went to join the 2nd Battalion and the Duke of Wellington's regiment in Delhi.
What kind of duties were you personally given at first?
I was just an ordinary infantry company officer.
What kind of duties were the Dukes carrying out in Delhi at that time?
In Delhi, the capital city, we had the job of guarding the vice-regal premises and the viceroy, and of internal security and peace and quiet in the old city of Old Delhi, and do what training we could in the country round about for general war.
Was there any sign of agitation or disturbance in India at that time?
Not in the central province, no. But, and we had small troubles in the bazaar in Delhi, in Old Delhi, with a Sikh demonstration one occasion, I remember. But otherwise, it was peace and quiet.
What was the Sikh demonstration about?
They were dissatisfied. Sikhs were generally dissatisfied, and now and again it came to the boil.
Did you stay in Delhi long?
No, 2 years, and then we moved up to Peshawar.
Any incidents that happened to you in Delhi that we should record?
No, I don't think it was anything special. We beat everybody at rugby football. We did that whenever we went.
So you went to Peshawar in 41?
In the autumn of 1941, yes.
What happened to you then?
Well, there it was a complete change. It was an operational station, really. It was the centre of control of the Northwest Frontier Province, and we had to learn the job of keeping the peace amongst the tribes on the Northwest Frontier of India, the Wazirs and the Pathans. We did this based on the very lowest form of equipment. It was really World War I equipment. And we had no vehicles, no wireless sets, no mortars. We were on animal transport. And visual means of communication, including the old flag, lamp, and heliograph. I became the battalion signals officer, having done a course at the Indian School of Signals at Pune. So from Peshawar onwards and through the coming campaign, I was the signals officer.
Did you experience fighting yourself?
At what stage?
On the frontier.
No. None of us did, really. But on one occasion, we were training in tribal territory, and the tribesmen opened up on us at a range of about 500 yards just to see what sort of people we were, I suppose. And we had 3 men hit, 1 in the head, but they all recovered. So it wasn't a phony war up there.
About how many months were you up there for?
Well, we were only there 2 months, 2.5 months, when we were ordered to mobilize.
Can you tell me what happened, please?
Well, we were in camp, training in frontier warfare, when the news came in that we had a week to mobilize for a station overseas, and it turned out we achieved that, and we got in a train at Peshawar, and a week in that train we got down to Madras, boarded a little ship called Varsova, which took us over to Rangoon along with 1 or 2 other units, including a mountain artillery battery which lashed its little screw guns into the rails as a minor form of protection as we crossed the sea to get to Madras, to get to Rangoon.
And the equipment that you took with you?
We took all... Oh, mobilization includes drawing up all the latest equipment. So we got rid of all our funny things and drew up the latest available to India from Rawalpindi Arsenal. And so we landed in Burma with a full set of new kit.
In what mood did the battalion go across to Burma in?
In great heart, I'm sure. We were a bit shaken halfway. Well, as we came into Rangoon, we got the news over the radio that Singapore had fallen, so that didn't That shook us a bit, because we could see what was going to happen.
And then?
We landed. They gave us a minimum time to shake ourselves out, unpack the stores, which we'd never trained with, and get ourselves ready to move as quickly as possible. We then moved out to the Gulf of Martaban, and there was a possible threat to that the Japs might come across the sea and do some assault landing, or they might parachute into Rangoon, and we were sent off to a flank to watch that to begin with. But then it all changed, and we were moved straight up to the front line by train. And the 17th Division had just withdrawn across the Bilin River, and they left a brigade at a place called Chaito, and we went straight and joined that brigade in the very front line facing the Japanese.
In what kind of terrain were you?
This was in low scrub. It wasn't really jungle, but there were low, scrubby sort of bushes or things. You couldn't see through it, but it wasn't very tall. There's a lot of rubber plantations around the developed villages and towns, and the roads were not made up. They were sort of gravelly sort of roads. Many of them.
Were you at that time in any contact with local civilians?
No. We personally hardly saw any, except in the huts and things in Chaito itself. But we were only there a night, so we hardly had a time to see anything.
What happened next?
Well, we were immediately told to withdraw. It's the biggest waste of time that ever happened, moving us up there. We went straight up to the front line and then stayed there a night and immediately started to withdraw. There's one rather amusing incident. I was sent off, having arrived in a new brigade as a signals officer, I was told to get in one of these newfangled things called jeeps, which we'd inherited at that stage, and drive into Chaito to brigade headquarters and report. Well, it was a strange country, a strange vehicle, a very strange situation for a young man. And there was a road, and along which a hell of a lot of lorries were pouring down from the Bilin River withdrawal. And I stopped one with an officer in front. I said, "Am I anywhere near the front line?" And he said, "Don't be a bloody fool. This is the front line," and drove straight off to the rear. So I wasn't very impressed by that.
What are your next recollections?
Well, we stayed that night, and there was desultory firing from the perimeter, a lot of small arms fire and variolites and tracer going up, but I think it was all panic stuff. I don't think there was anything really happening. It was, the Japanese may have been probing Chaito itself to see what was going on. Then the next afternoon, we were told to withdraw, and we withdrew across some open country to a rubber plantation just outside Chaito. And then I had my baptism of fire in World War II when we were attacked from the air by the Royal Air Force. And I remember distinctly a Wellington bomber coming absolutely straight at me at the height of about 200 or 300 feet. And I thought my last hour had come. But that was because somebody made a mistake. Anyway, we spent that night in the rubber plantation, and then the next day proceeded to march back to the Satang River, where was the only bridge across, at a place called Mok Palin. On the way back, we were rear guard, so we had to see everybody through. The Japanese put roadblocks out on the road which had to be cleared. I myself was rounded up by the adjutant, and he said, come on, we'll go and clear this small hill just beside the road in case it's, the Japanese are on it and we can interfere with our process. And we charged up this hill and got to the top, but there was nobody there, so we came back. But so I didn't see any real action on the withdrawal from Chaikto to the river Satang, although our rifle companies did.
How much at that time did you personally know of what was going on?
Well, we knew we were withdrawing to the river, but we didn't know what was going on, really, because there was obviously fighting on ahead, and we just... when that stopped, we proceeded on, and we, battalion headquarters and two companies, got through to Mot Pelin. A strange thing happened to the third company. It was told to wait behind and look after a Burma Rifles battalion that was lost. But we had to leave them there, and the Burma Rifles never appeared. And this company had made its way right round the ensuing battle and crossed the Satang River higher up in some boats. And the company commander found a telephone and rang up, and transport was sent and collected them and took them to a village called War. So they, W-A-W, so they had no part in the battle at the Satang. We'd already left one company on the Rangoon side of the Satang Bridge as a bridge guard, so we were only... two rifle companies strong and in the best of it, and they went straight in. And as it happened, we were very lost a lot of people.
And then?
Well, we stayed the night in Mot Pelin village, and there was rifle fire going over our heads, and nothing much happened. There was no contact. We had no food for a day, not much water, and it was very cold at night. We had no blankets or greatcoats or anything. We were just in our sweat-soaked shirts. But at first light, I managed to find some metal mule side load water containers and a tap, and we filled up these things, which really were like vast square kettles, and we found the ingredients from friendly artillery chaps round about, and at least my signal or two, and started that fatal day with a hot cup of hot mess tin full of tea. The gunners were lined up near us, and they were old 18-pounder guns from a reserve army unit of the Burma army, and they were firing. On one occasion, at each end of their gun lines, they had a Lewis gun. Well, Lewis guns were pretty well out of fashion and never seen, but they were still equipped with Lewis guns, just to show you the sort of ancient kit which people had. Anyway, one of these Lewis guns went into action against a reconnaissance aircraft which flew down the line, a Japanese reconnaissance aircraft, flew down the line of their guns, and they shot it down. And it landed amongst our troops. The pilot survived. And the day wore on. Later, some very heavy British bombers, Royal Air Force bombers, came over and from a great height dropped quite a lot of bombs beyond us on what would presumably be Japanese positions. About tea time, I decided that the rest of the battalion had gone on to cross the river near the bridge. I decided I'd been told to stay around in Mopelin village. I decided it was time to go, and I made my way down to the river. By this time, I was accompanied by a private in the regiment next to us. And we picked up a very badly wounded soldier who'd got his knee smashed by a mortar bomb, and we got him down to the edge of the river, which was 800 yards wide at this stage and fairly fast flowing. And as luck would have it, a raft made of about six banana tree stumps lashed together, and we got hold of this and put our man onto them and stripped off the vests and pants, retaining my only weapon, which was a 4-5 revolver, and slowly pushed this raft across the 800 yards on a nice sunny afternoon and nobody else in sight at that stage, and got across the river that way. I was no difficulty, having spent a lot of my summer holidays in Norfolk swimming. I had no difficulty in swimming, and nor Corporal Private Burns. And we got our man across the river.
You mean the raft just happened to be floating along the river?
It just floated down. See, above us was the bridge, and a lot of people had made rafts there, and some had, this one must have done its stuff and floated, and got where it was to where he wanted to go, and then floated down, because the bridge was, you couldn't really see the bridge from where we were. This little raft just happened to come into the side of the river where we were. So that was very lucky. Anyway, we got to the far side. It's impossible to carry this man because he's a smashed knee. But we tried at our best. But luckily, further on across the rice fields, we saw a bullock cart with a number of troops around it. The battalion had been on our flank in the battle, in the Mopelin village. Loading on their second in command, who I'd seen knocked over by a mortar earlier in the day. And they agreed, as the soldier belonged to their unit, they agreed for the soldier to go on this bullock cart too. So he got, thanks to us largely, got safely away. And then Private Burns and I walked to a considerable hubbub which was coming from over the other side of the paddy fields, which turned out to be war. WAW, railway station, where all the troops which were coming across the river were gathering. And it was on the railway, and a train was in, loading up. And Burns pushed off and joined his mates, and I found myself standing next to a carriage in which was the CEO of the Jarts, with a few of his Viceroy Commissioned officers. And he said, come on, get in. So I joined him in his carriage. He was being well looked after with blankets and things by his Indian warrant officers. And he said, this Jemadar here was in the village where your colonel was murdered earlier in the day. And he took rough justice and revenge for this brutal murder by the locals. You couldn't really blame the Burmans because they didn't know what the hell was going on, what on earth was going on. There was Japanese and English troops all over the place, and they murdered our colonel, Basil Owen. There were at least three COs killed in the fighting round Mopelin and Satang Bridge. Anyway, the train took off and took us to Pegu, where further reorganization took place. The Japanese didn't follow up. And we, 25 Armored Brigade had arrived and were making themselves felt, and other troops had arrived from India, and we had time to get some sort of equipment out of the stores in Rangoon, which wasn't so far away. And every day trucks went down and got clothing, weapons, and we reorganized into a total of two companies, and battalion headquarters, and were sort of equipped to fight. But we had no signals equipment except line and a few telephones. I think you probably heard quite a lot about the actual fighting already from other officers that went on round the bridge.
Well,
I wasn't there, so I can't
give a point of view.
I can't give a personal, but they had a very nasty time. And so there we were in Pegu, and then when we were equipped, we moved a bit further back to another place called Legu, Helegu, H-L-E-G-U. And then we made a move to the Taukchon roadblock, the road junction, which was where the road from Rangoon joined the road from Pegu and the Satang situation, and joined together and formed the main trunk road to Mandalay. But the Japanese by now had followed up, and although a counterattack had been made at Pegu, it hadn't been successful, and the Japanese were able to put a roadblock across the road at Taukchon. Here, sadly, one of our best officers and the son of a general, the grandson of a general, a chap called Christensen, was with his carrier platoon and was the first to find the Jap roadblock and walked up to it to see what it was all about, so that he could report what strength it was and so on. And John Christensen was killed there, and two of his carriers knocked out. A very sad occasion. At the same time, across on the paddy field, I caught sight of General Alexander with his red hat on, standing there waiting for us to clear the road, looking completely cool and calm and encouraging. I remember him standing there. And the day wore on, and it was very hot, and various attempts were made to clear the roadblock, but the troops we were with, the brigadier decided that we would do the most extraordinary thing. As dark fell, we fell in to a column of six ranks, like a long snake of troops, with an intelligence officer in front. And we marched across country all night in the direction we knew we had to go to get clear of the roadblocks and get back onto the road.